Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome to the first Tech Weekly podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and joining me to make heads and tails of the world of technology are Jemima Kish, Bobby Johnson, and Charles Arthur, each members of the underground digital elite. Welcome, guys. Thank you very much for coming along.
Hello.
Hello, Jemima.
Season's greetings.
Indeed, indeed. And you're a vegetarian. What are you going to be eating this year for your Christmas?
Cashew nut roast, what I hunted myself.
Well done. Up in the Highlands of Scotland.
Yeah.
Bobby, how about you? What are you going to be doing for Christmas this year?
I think absolutely bugger all, I think, is the plan.
Sitting around with your new toys.
Watching TV and getting drunk. That's what Christmas is for.
Sponsored by Bailey's.
Charles.
I think we're all heading to a relative and we're going to have lashings of Christmas food until we all lie around senseless.
And explode. Mm. Oh, man, that sounds good. I'm really looking forward to it. Well, this week, before we go off and enjoy our Christmas roasts, nut or otherwise, we are laying the foundation for the future of this podcast, ensuring that everyone is on the same digital page as we move forward in our journey through the bits and bytes of the Matrix. Welcome to the 2007 Technology Review. Over the next 20 or so minutes, we'll rush you through the highs and the lows, the peaks and the pitfalls of this year in gadgetry, including the skinny on the iPhone, the state of the Facebook nation, the games that made a difference, and what technology did for the world. Let's start out with the shiniest gadget of the decade, the iPhone.
And this is the home screen of iPhone right here. And so if I want to get in the iPod, I just go down that lower right-hand corner and push this icon right here, and boom, I'm in the iPod. Well, how do I scroll through my list of artists? I just take my finger and I scroll.
That's it. Listen to that rapture. Listen to that joy. Can you hear the sort of hysteria surrounding that? That was Steve Jobs announcing the iPhone at Macworld in January. Jemima, you were just demonstrating what Steve was saying on the tin. I felt myself bubbling over.
Do you know what?
Rapture.
It was always the people that really loved Macs that really put me off Macs, and now I find myself completely obsessed as well. But it's an amazing gadget. The touchscreen, I think, is the single most impressive thing. And also for people like me that were already using iTunes and iCal and Mail, you know, one plug-in and everything syncs up, which is a real gift. This is a bit of a case of early birds catching a slightly less podgy worm, though, because the UK version uses Edge technology to connect to Tinterweb and stuff, and that's not very fast, and there are lots and lots of rumours about a 3G version coming out in January.
Yes,
so
that's
I
quite exciting,
will probably
it?
Be kicking myself a lot.
Well, but, caught quite a pretty worm, I have
yes,
to say.
Yes, it's a very pretty worm. I don't mind being locked in their walled garden because it's so beautiful inside.
Well, actually, you mentioned all these things. You know, you'd already played around with Mac technology, you'd played with the iCal, you were engendered in the whole culture. Is it really a walled garden? Do you find yourself limited by what's going on in your iPhone, which is going on?
Making those little blippy noises.
Seems to work.
Well, I mean, there are desktop products for Macs. There's a great product called Newsfire, which is the RSS reader I use that I absolutely adore. But at the moment, unless you nobble your iPhone, you can't get any applications for it, which is a real shame because I saw a guy who had about 30 amazing applications that do everything from kind of monitor your menstrual cycle to sort of suggest new tunes to find and stuff. Some really cool stuff, but they've got to open that up. I think they are.
I think we'll get to that later, I think. But
you might not need that actual application.
One of the things I'm interested in, though, is this idea, you know, when's a 3G iPhone coming? And actually, I don't think we'll see it in January. I think we'll see it a lot further down the line, because what the iPhone does, I think, which is crucial that other handsets don't, is it's all based around software. You know, the phone, okay, it's a 2.5G phone, it's not a 3G phone, but apart from that, everything else is based in software updates. So you get a new firmware update, it fixes the bugs, it does all of that stuff. So that's a much more computery way of thinking about things. And I think that's really one of the big changes that Apple's bringing to the table with iPhone. And we hear Steve Jobs going on and people screaming, and I was there at that announcement in January, you know, and people went absolutely crazy for it. But you have to look at what's the big picture here. Are they actually changing anything? Lots of people say no, particularly other manufacturers who say, have a look at our phones, guys. But I think they've certainly captured a spirit
But the industry really needed a kick up the arse. I mean, for as long as I can remember, people were saying mobile's the next big thing, and it's just it hasn't happened year after year.
To me, the really interesting thing is that Apple takes these things. It sort of gives you a lowest common denominator, but it makes it really completely solid, and it makes it utterly easy to use.
Well, the litmus test was putting my mum on the iPhone, who, you know, and she can barely use a computer and she can't really use her mobile phone, and she just knew what to do and what buttons to press.
I mean, that's the sort of key thing, isn't it? Is that people have been saying, well, how could you have an iPhone that's not got 3G? It's more that I think it puts these capabilities within your reach much more easily and builds on those. Mm.
What I've noticed actually is that it has really had its uptake because the other manufacturers are making phones that look awfully like iPhones.
The LG Beauty, for example. Yeah. Or many other models that are out there at the moment.
Do we see Apple taking over the world?
I think that the mobile phone world is so enormous. I mean, you're talking about billions of phones out there, so much bigger than the PC world, that it really doesn't have a chance of taking it over. I mean, it's not as if it's taken over the computer world.
He stated that he wanted 1%, though.
Yeah, exactly. 1%. I mean, if they cream off the top 1%, then they're making pots of money. I mean, it's not as if it's a cheap contract in the US or in the UK. Mm. So, you know, I think they can, you know, Apple can be very happy if they cream off that top 1%.
Well, especially if they manage to continue to kind of strong arm the operators, giving them a revenue share, yes, which is, you know, quite an amazing feat.
So next up is the grown-ups' take on MySpace without the Cole eyeliner and emo overtones.
Today, together, we're going to start a movement. Welcome to F8. We're here to unveil the next evolution of Facebook platform. This is a big day for Facebook. And we hope it's a big day for you too.
Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook talking about the next generation of social interaction and his big day. So the social networking phenomenon has finally reached the chattering classes with Facebook. Bobby, what is your Facebook status today?
Bobby isn't doing anything. I've given up Facebook status updates just because I get so bored of them. But that's not to say there aren't many people who are enjoying it greatly. And I think that's what's been really interesting about Facebook this year is, okay, it still doesn't have the same user numbers as something like MySpace, but what it has done is take it mainstream in a different way. So MySpace is still mainly about teenagers and young people, the kind of, you know, digital natives that are already using these kind of services. What Facebook's done, and, you know, in offices up and down the country, in all you see are people using Facebook. You know, there's 50 million plus users around the world. Millions in the UK. I mean, there are nearly 2 million associated to the London network alone. And so, you know, they've really hit a nerve, struck a chord with people. But they've had a lot of problems as well. I mean, most specifically with Beacon, their advertising revenue generator. But people rebelled against the idea of that quite seriously, and they've kind of changed their terms and conditions on that. So, I mean, we've seen that Facebook has this place very quickly in people's lives, but maybe it ain't all it's cracked up to be.
Well, of course, nothing can ever be a catch-all for something like this. And it's interesting to see how people have moved from MySpace to Facebook. It's as if it is an okay platform for people to play around with. Jemima?
But it's managed to pull in a lot of people that wouldn't have bothered with MySpace. Because it's a bit sort of mucky and graphic-y. But yeah, there are lots of people that weren't really into these things that were maybe more sort of Friends Reunited people.
Absolutely.
Sorry to use such filthy language in here.
I think the design aspect of it is quite crucial, actually, because it kind of, when you log on, it kind of looks a bit like a spreadsheet or something. You know, it looks like a document almost that you could be looking at. It doesn't have that offensive flash. You know, there's no blink tags on
well,
there
you know,
or anything,
that's you know? What worked for Google from the beginning. And actually, good design is about function. Form follows function. It doesn't need clutter. It doesn't need flashing bits. That's part of the reason that it's been so successful, definitely.
Yeah, and it does look like a grown-up application. But what is interesting is to see how the community has rebelled, whether it's to do with the advertising or even to opening up the
Yeah,
college
I mean the applications. You say it's a grown-up platform. I spend most of my day repelling bites from zombies. You know, it's kind of it's hit this weird place in the world, I think, between being grown up and being playful at the same time. There are other things, I think, that we really have to look at Facebook as well. It's trying desperately to embed itself mm-hmm. in internet culture as fast as it can. And, you know, it's taken funding from Microsoft this year. Mm. It's really working very hard. It's starting to poach people from Google, which is a pretty hard thing to do. You know, it's bringing staff over. You know, maybe we can overblow this, but I think they're moving so fast, and they're clearly they don't want to sell the company as well, which I think is a
it's an IPO, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, Charles, tell me your take on that.
I was thinking that really what Facebook needs in order to actually have its growth be successful and sustained is for people to go there and to stay there. For that, it needs people to trust it so that they would be reading their web feeds and they'd be reading their email and they'd be reading their instant messaging all through the Facebook page. You'd need to trust it. Like that.
At the same time, though, I think that there is a real movement away from doing that, from bringing people to an internet page and keeping them there. There seems to be a movement in this whole...
But that's just what they want to do. His stated aim is to create the internet within the internet.
I mean, I can believe that there'd be some younger people joining the internet who would want to live their life through their Facebook page, you know, that they wouldn't really bother through email, that if they can pipe their email through to Facebook, they'd be happy.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the rebirth of the portal, really, through the back door, yeah. You know, they get you in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, the new Yahoo.
So Facebook, we all think, seems to have a future. We're just not quite sure where that future is, as a portal or as a place for people to come to and disappear. Jemima, just quickly, you look like you want to say something.
Yeah, the future is targeted advertising, but I think we're going to talk about that in the next show.
We'll talk about that in the next show. But in the meantime, Macs and PCs had drastic rehauls this year with the releases of new operating systems for both hardwares, Leopard for Mac and Vista for Windows and PC. Let's hear what Bill Gates has to say about this.
Everything's becoming digital, and the platform that allows people to be creative and build new applications and show off new hardware advances, that's a central element that allows it all to thrive. So Windows 95 was key to its era, and Windows Vista is key to the era we have today.
That's Bill talking about keys. Charles, what do you think?
Well, I have to say, you listen to that and you think, what on earth is he saying there? I mean, what is it that Vista does that
anything
else doesn't do?
Everything's becoming digital.
Yeah, well,
what insight.
I think we knew that already. Vista launched in January, having been much delayed, having pretty much driven Microsoft on a death march. Consumers were able to get their hands on it, and the reaction wasn't good because a lot of manufacturers hadn't gone to the trouble of updating drivers for software, for things like scanners and printers. And by the end of the year, there were around 250 million PCs sold this year, and the expectation is that about 100 million licenses of Vista will be sold. Mm. That's a lot of licenses, but it's really not the sort of uptake that Microsoft might have hoped for.
I know several people who've actually wanted to buy PCs and then have decided not to on the basis of Vista being installed already.
Oh, that's not what they want to hear.
And Dell, for example, began offering people the chance to downgrade from Vista to XP a couple of months after it appeared. Dixon Store Group took some fairly hefty write-downs because people weren't buying Vista machines in the amounts they were expecting. The question is why? Why has Vista just not done the job? Joe Wilcox at Microsoft Watch did a really interesting analysis where he looked at various reasons why this might be. The key ones he came up with was that the Windows ecosystem, which is all the companies that build things around it, A, weren't ready, and he says it's still not ready for the ecosystem, it's not ready for Vista, and may never be, because he thinks that they're just not going to go to the trouble of rewriting these drivers and so on. And he says that the other thing is that the Windows XP ecosystem is so strong that it, in effect, pulls people back. People say, well, you know, it's good enough. I was reading a blog post by the guy who runs a company called NewsGator, who said that he was considering upgrading to Vista, and then he thought, no, I won't, because actually I don't want to have to upset all the calibration and all the scanners and all the things and find the drivers and download and blah, blah, blah. He then bought a Mac.
I think this is one of the interesting things, because actually, you know, it's not that the manufacturers and people didn't have time, I don't think, because Vista was such a long time coming. It's that there was no compelling reason. Vista didn't offer anything. Nobody could see why they had to buy into Vista straight off the bat. Mm. And I think actually it's kind of the same with Leopard at the moment with Mac. I mean, all that Apple have over you is they force you to upgrade in order to get software updates and things like that.
Yeah. It came out at the very end of October. That was the financial statement thing,
was really, wasn't it? It was to squeeze it into their next
result. Just to get it in there. 2 million copies sold in the first weekend, and everyone said, what did it do? But there were some big flaws in the Gold Master version of Leopard. It had one where if you copied a file from one partition to the next, it would delete the file. It had another where the wireless was incredibly flaky, and the point update to the operating system to fix all the bugs came out pretty soon afterwards, and it was a long list of bugs.
Jemima, would you say that, you know, they've done a Windows with Leopard?
Don't do operating systems. Sorry.
That's good. I mean, I've got to say, my take on it would be that both companies had a chance to really make an incredible impression, and they both missed it.
Yeah, or their eyes were on a different prize. You know, Microsoft was looking at its web business and saying, crikey, Google's got one over on us here. We need to sort this stuff out. Apple was looking at the iPhone, and they forgot what the fundamentals of both their businesses are, which is desktop operating systems.
Similarly, it's also been a very big year for games.
52.
Rock. Paper, scissors.
There you go. Paper.
If there's one reason why we're here, it's because of the chief.
Any sign of the chief? Negative, sir. I think we lost him.
Not yet.
And that was Nicole Kidman navigating brain training for the Nintendo DS in the TV ads. Actually, it's Brain Training 2.
Is there an exercise on there that will help her work out why she's wearing so much makeup, do you think?
And also the sound of napalm in the morning from Halo 3. So this year has actually been an enormous year for games when you think about it. We had the launch of the PlayStation 3, at least in the UK, 4 whole months after the launch of the machine in the US and Japan. By the time it reached these shores, British gamers were extremely pissed off, to be quite frank. They were really irritated because the price point was too high. The software still hadn't launched. The online capabilities were patchy, and the actual controller was having a lot of issues. And so basically what we got was effectively a substandard machine, followed by the fact that the Nintendo Wii, which had been the furthest behind in the console stakes, suddenly rushed to the fore because everybody and their uncle and their grandmother and their dog was playing on a Nintendo Wii. So this machine had the massive crossover appeal.
The Wii, which has the least advanced technology of the three principal consoles, is selling by far the best. It's sold out everywhere.
And also, I think the DS, nobody can find the DS anywhere.
Four million now in the UK DSs. It's incredible.
And where's the PlayStation Portable? I seem to recall loads of things that Guardian Technology wrote about that when it launched, and yet you have trouble seeing them.
And I think that is because your grandmother can't just pick it up and play with it, whereas with the Wii, they can flail their arms around and they can produce some kind of interaction with the television.
But actually also the titles that have become available this year have really underpinned things.
Absolutely, and I think that people are relying very much upon the two staple games, Wii Sports, which is the one with tennis and bowling, and Wii Play, which is just very simple games. And I think that certainly Nintendo has got to play its cards very carefully if it wants to maintain that attraction to the mainstream and to that crossover audience. Interestingly, the biggest news of the year was, of course, Halo and Halo 3, the launch of Halo 3, which in its first weekend outsold Superman 3. The gaming community went completely bonkers, and then that bit of software kind of disappeared. Spider-Man 3, not Superman 3. And then finally, when we're looking at games and what's happened this year, there have been two controversial approaches. One of them was Manhunt 2. Manhunt 2 was released earlier this year in the States, but to date it still hasn't received a certificate from the BBFC to be released over here.
We can talk about censorship questions a lot, and whether actually what the Manhunt 2 controversy shows is that we're not good enough at only supplying adult games to adults. If you go into a shop and you always see a parent buying their kid GTA or something, you know, it's pretty obvious that the rules are fairly lax. But I think the really interesting thing is that there was a real divide inside the game industry about whether they thought Manhunt 2 should be banned or shouldn't be banned. And a lot of people found it hard to navigate between the kind of distasteful, what they felt was kind of gratuitous violence, distasteful violence and all that kind of stuff, and the freedom to play what you like. And I think a lot of it was just everything coming back full circle on Rockstar. They've been so good at courting controversy over the past few years, and it's clearly part of their marketing strategy. And a lot of people looked at them and said, Manhunt 2's been banned. That's your fault. You were deliberately crossing the line.
Yeah.
And I think that is a new thread inside the industry that we haven't seen before necessarily.
And it should be very interesting to see how that plays out. Get it? See the pun there? Over the next 12 months. It's also been a bad year for Alistair Darling.
Mr. Speaker, the missing information contains details of all child benefit recipients, records for 25 million individuals and 7.25 million families. These records include the recipient and their children's names, addresses and dates of birth. It includes child benefit numbers, national insurance numbers and, where relevant, bank or building society account details. Mr. Speaker, I regard this as an extremely serious failure by HMRC in the responsibility to the public.
Charles, can you explain what this is all about?
As I think pretty much everyone in the UK knows, this was HMRC, which got EDS, which carries out its data processing for it, to dump the database of child benefit details onto a couple of CDs, stuck them into the post, sent to the National Audit Office, which wanted to do a study on how accurately child benefits were paid. Even though the National Audit Office didn't want all the bank details, and what it showed up was that within government, there's a really systemic failure in the way that data is managed, in the way that data is passed between departments, in the way that data is passed from government departments to outside organisations.
Really? Government lecturing us on, you know, how we protect ourselves, and then it goes and dishes out all our personal details to who knows?
Well, yes, the whole ID card issue is not looking so likely now, is it? On the plus side.
It's losing a lot of support. I think the Conservatives have dropped their support for it. The Lib Dems are against it. And the question is whether Labour can continue to shore up its support for the whole ID card thing.
We hear lots of stuff about, you know, people must protect themselves online. And when you get to something like this, you think, well, what's the point anyway?
It's a systemic problem, and those are really, really hard to root out. Within the civil service, I did work right at the very beginning of my career in the civil service. Systemic problems within the civil service are really hard to root out. And this will have taken hold because this is all about moving the data processing out of the expertise of the civil service. So there's no one in there who is able to say, all we need to do is just, you know, run a quick SQL query. We'll dump this. We won't include the account details. You know, it's a sort of work of a minute if you have the expertise.
Mm. But you don't even know about it.
If you don't, then you get charged £5,000 by EDS for doing the extra work. And they say, that'll put us over budget. We better have the whole lot.
I think both of you really sort of touched on it when you were talking about the fact that people were giving this stuff willingly. And, you know, we don't necessarily know what to do with it. And Jemima, I'm just going to ask a random question. Have you ever put your mobile phone number or a phone number on Facebook?
I mean, this is my yet another phone. Example. I suppose I'm fairly careful about what I put online. I always use my real name on everything I do. But because I do that, I only ever put information I'm sort of, you know, quite happy to have my name against. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, it's crazy worrying about what you put into, I don't know, some kind of social networking website when anyone can just kind of, who is my website, get my home address anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, dear, possibly. Did I just say that? But you know, if you know what you're doing online, you can get all sorts of information. And
yeah.
You know, you can protect your who is as long as you're not selling anything on the website. Mm. You can
make a private individual in the UK.
I've never got around to doing that.
But what is?
Better do it tonight.
I did an exercise like this a few weeks ago, actually. I was talking to a friend of mine at Cambridge and said, find out what you can in 2 minutes on me. He found out a lot of things about me, a lot of things about my girlfriend, places we'd been, and built up. You know, effectively, he'd be able to steal my identity quite quickly. And I'm fairly profligate with information online. I chuck it out there. I don't really care. But I'm
internet.
This is only.
What you're saying.
This is what people are doing more and more. I'm not a talk.
but the thing is that we're putting that information out there ourselves. I mean, he would have found out where you've been by looking at, say, your Flickr set or something like that. The interesting thing is that we get exercised about the government having posted these CDs because we know that there's a better way for them to do it. When it comes to putting out information about ourselves online about where we went for our holidays or whatever, that's the sort of thing that we do. We're exercising a certain amount of choice.
To be fair, you know, putting some holiday snaps from when I went to Malta on Flickr is soft data, you know, your bank details. Yeah. That's hard data. And like you said, that's why people are riled.
There's so much to discuss on this topic, whether it's soft data, hard data, you know, behavioral data. But we won't get into that because thus far in the program, we've been relatively downtrodden. To wind up, let's just take a quick look at what technology has done for good in 2007.
We have Sistran tools. So, you know, the kids in China can talk to the kids in Brazil and Rwanda and find out what life is like there. And they've got their little video cameras and they can show like how they live and what kind of animals are there. And it's a really cool way to learn about the world by kids talking to kids to find out stuff.
That was Mary Lou Jepson, a technology officer at One Laptop Per Child. One Laptop Per Child has had a lot of media attention this year. And I wanted to find out on the whole whether it's been a good year for technology.
Well, I think OLPC, which aims to get low-cost, innovative laptops to children in developing countries, is a kind of standard bearer for a whole number of projects and individuals who are wanting to use their influence and power and technology to change the world for the better. One Laptop has had a really kind of an up and down year, I think is a polite way to put it. They've really struggled to get orders in. Their machines are, I haven't used one, but from reports that I've had from friends who have, they're really interesting and innovative. And there's technology in there that could be really useful, low power screens, you know, things that could have a real impact. But they've really struggled and they face a lot of competition from commercial competitors who want to take them on. But we've also seen Bill Gates, who is now moving into this role, dishing his money out, giving it away to people and concentrating on charity work and moving away from Microsoft. And you've got companies like Google, who are now putting their money behind these energy initiatives. So they want to make renewable energy cheaper than coal now, and they're pumping millions and millions into it. It's hard to pin down exactly why it's happening. But this idea that changing the world, not just selling products, might be a way that you can enhance things.
It seems though that we've seen this before, you know, with the early days of the web. It feels very strange.
Oh, you don't look old enough, Alex.
Too kind, Jemima. And by the way, I like that top. but back in the mid-90s, we had a lot of the new recruits coming in and saying, brilliant, we've made our millions off tripod or whatever. Let's go out and create an initiative that's gonna make the world a better place. So it's almost as if we're seeing this cycle again.
I think there's an interesting question in, do these people want to make money in order to save the world, or do they want to make money and then they feel so guilty about having made the money that then they decide the only way to get rid of it
latter.
Is to save the world?
I think it's the latter.
Yeah. I think they find they have so much time on their hands that they might as well save the world. You know, it's sort of,
in their lunchtime, yeah.
But these things, maybe it's that 2007 was the year that these things got more media attention, because these things have been bubbling up for a long time.
Yeah, green and kind of ethical business practices got to the mainstream.
Yeah.
OLPC is a really interesting initiative, but the intriguing thing is that, you know, the fantastic technologies in it hits the politics side when you go into countries where, you know, a certain amount of graft and backhanders are the way of life. Suddenly the OLPC, which is in effect a charity, finds that it's running into much bigger commercial interests who aren't so keen on having a very cheap laptop and would rather there was a slightly more expensive laptop.
And they already know how to grease the wheels in whatever way that may be. And I think the other thing about OLPC is that everybody always says, oh, well, shouldn't we be giving money to these countries to, you know, to give them food and stuff like that? It's actually aiming, you know, it's countries that are at this halfway point between being a country without infrastructure and being a westernized country, and they're pitching at this place in the middle and hoping that they can quickly elevate, you know, the levels of learning and the levels of knowledge that are out there, and, you know, create a new Silicon Valley somewhere else in the world or in many other places in the world. To be fair to them, we shouldn't always concentrate on, you know, poverty.
No, absolutely. And I think that at least they're doing small things. You know, if they weren't doing anything, then certainly we could rip them apart for that. But in the meantime, we are wrapping up here. That has been the year in technology, and this has been the first Tech Weekly podcast. I have been Alex Kratosky, and thanks as always to Jemima, Bobby, Charles, and our intrepid producer, Scott. Until next time, when we forecast the best of 2008. Have a great Christmas.
Guardian Unlimited.